America Trends Podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.
What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. I'm Larry Rifkin. We know the impact that COVID has had on an overburdened medical system in response to the inability to get medical attention because of the pressures on the system. We find a new trend. Patients are turning to the internet and products advertised there to monitor and test themselves. While they wait not so patiently to see their own doctor, it's do-it-yourself healthcare. In a sense, this is nothing new. Lawmakers and regulators have steadily limited the scope of acceptable treatments, but Americans still have gone their own way in looking for alternatives. I must say that when you look at cures in the 19th century for what ails us, I really don't know how the species has made it this far. Please, don't try leeches. We'll discuss how Americans' desire for medical free will expresses itself today, only here on America Trends.
With us on America Trends is Lewis Grossman, and he's written a book called Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America. And this is a very involved book and very interesting as well, because you tell us that throughout American history, a broad swath of the population has believed that people have a right to choose their own preferred treatments without government interference. And that's got to be part of the American trend or the American sense of liberty and freedom. And it also probably, I think, has something to do with the fact that a lot of the medicine that was prescribed back in previous centuries didn't really have a lot of medical underpinning to support it.
Yeah, that's right, Larry, and thank you for having me on today. It certainly is easy to point to medicine in the 19th century or late 18th century and say, of course there was freedom of therapeutic choice because the orthodox doctors didn't know what they were doing any more than the alternative practitioners did. What I find striking is that following a period of great trust in America's medical establishment and government health regulation in the mid-20th century, with the rise of modern clinical medicine, starting in the 1970s, despite the rise of modern medical science, we have seen a very, very robust tendency of Americans to demand freedom of therapeutic choice, even in the modern age.
You remind us that that was an anomalous period in many ways, because in that period, we trusted a lot of institutions a whole lot more than we seem to today, whether it's the media, whether it's religion, and again, the medical establishment got caught up in that as well. And yet many of us might look back and say, haven't we always put great faith in the guy with the white coat or the woman with the white coat, and we've believed that they knew so much more than the rest of us. They had so much more training and ability to really diagnose what was going on. Or have we always had great confidence in our own ability to find our own remedies?
In the middle of the 20th century, it was indeed the case that people had so much trust in authority figures and establishment institutions and medical science that they didn't really make it their business to understand medicine and their own health they tended to simply rely on the man in the white coat, as you said. But I trace in this book how, starting in the 1970s in particular, that dynamic completely changed. And whether you're talking about the rise of alternative medicine starting in the 1970s, or even the rise of citizen activism in the world of orthodox medicine with the AIDS activists in the late 1980s, we are no longer in a world where there is inevitable trust in the man in the white coat. And we're also in a world where, with the rise of the internet, other sources of information, patients are themselves often highly educated and sometimes miseducated, but often highly educated in the areas of medicine that they're concerned about, and are often able to take on both the drug companies and the medical establishment in sophisticated terms.
Now, let's go back to a time when we didn't have the CDC, the FDA. I mean, at that point in time, before all of these new conventions and regulatory agencies came about, what were the alternatives that people wanted, or what was it that they took from the medical establishment as gospel, and what were they challenging?
Well, if you go all the way back to the 19th century, I assume that those who followed orthodox medicine trusted those men in the white coats. But there was a huge variety of alternative approaches during the 19th century whose followers were just as convinced of the efficacy of their modalities as the orthodox doctors were in theirs. These included a very, very powerful, large botanical medicine movement in the early 19th century that I described, called the Thompsonians. It included homeopaths in the late 19th century. It included the rise of what were known as drugless approaches, including osteopathy and chiropractic and Christian Science and Mind Cure. The other thing to understand, if you're looking at it in terms of American history, is that the rise of modern government regulation of drugs and medicine, as you alluded to, for example, the FDA and the CDC, is a relatively new thing. If you look back to the 19th century, the source of medical regulation was not the federal government, it was more the state governments. And it wasn't so much regulation of pharmaceutical products as it was regulation of medical practice. States had medical practice acts, which were basically medical licensing laws, and these were used in ways to try to suppress alternative practitioners, non-orthodox practitioners, and the resistance to these medical practice acts, which was often quite successful, bore many of the same characteristics and used a lot of the same rhetoric as modern medical freedom activism that's used against the federal government.
Let me take us to the present and work us back to the Right to Try Act under the Trump administration, and again, allowing people to perhaps in desperate circumstance and in more terminal cases really find access to drugs that are not yet available widely and generally. I don't think too many people have taken advantage of this Right to Try Act, but how much of this is really part of the American tradition?
Very much part of the American tradition. The particular statute you're speaking about that was passed during the Trump administration has been kind of a paper tiger. Very, very few people have taken advantage of it. But one reason so few people have taken advantage of it is because the AIDS activists had already established fairly systematized ways to get access to drugs prior to approval without having to cut the FDA out of the process. The FDA was never really the problem. And what the Trankett-Wendler Act does, that's the Right to Try Act, is it cuts FDA out of the process altogether. Obviously, a pharmaceutical company doesn't have any particular motivation to do that. Now, I will say that even if the desire to try drugs prior to approval is baked into the American DNA, even after the AIDS activists and their successes, that is not where you see the most dramatic impacts. Rather, you see the most dramatic impacts in the faster and earlier approval of drugs, and the approval of drugs based on less evidence than drugs used to be approved on.
In your writings, you talk a lot about the Abigail Alliance case. Explain to us the importance of that.
So Abigail Burroughs was a young woman who, at the turn of the 21st century, acquired head and neck cancer. Every available therapy was tried and failed. And so she wanted to gain access to a drug that had gone through the earliest studies, known as phase 1 trials, prior to FDA approval. And she tried to gain access to these drugs and failed to gain access to these drugs, in large part, by the way, because FDA banned the sale of these drugs prior to approval. After she tragically passed away, her father started an organization called Abigail Alliance, which sued FDA and argued that people in Abigail's situation and other desperate patients have a substantive due process right to acquire drugs prior to approval. Ultimately, the D.C. Circuit, which is the probably most important court in the United States following the U.S. Supreme Court, denied that claim and said that people don't have a substantive due process right to acquire drugs prior to approval. What I found particularly interesting in the Abigail Alliance case, other than the sheer pathos of her story and the interesting debate over whether or not she should have been able to get these drugs, was the use of history in that opinion. The court in that opinion used a test of substantive due process that asks whether a right is deeply rooted in America's history and traditions. So this was the door that I walked through to examine whether or not freedom of therapeutic choice is in fact deeply rooted in America's history and traditions. After performing this research, I think that the history is both a lot more complex and a lot more interesting than the judges in that case thought.
Well, when I think about this issue, you know, I still hear about a lot of people going outside of the United States for alternative therapies that they can't get here. And I really wonder to myself, I mean, are we regulated heavily in the United States in comparison to other nations as to what it is that somebody can ingest or somebody can try experimentally because they have run out of hope about allopathic medicine and they want to try something different? And we know that there are so many movements. Obviously, the book recognizes that in homeopathy and naturopathic and such. So again, where does America really stand in that regard, particularly in this liberty-loving country?
I would say that to answer that question, it's not enough to look at court decisions and the letter of statutes and regulations, because there is actually very, very broad access to unapproved drugs and medical devices in America. Let's start with alternative medicine. Even though almost every alternative drug and alternative device is, as a formal matter, illegal under the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, they are still readily available in the United States. And I trace this development. I point to a paradox, which is, why is it with the rise of the randomized controlled study and its embodiment in American law in the 1960s, why is it that since the 1970s, there's been this efflorescence in the United States of alternative medicine without government interference? And I think it's ultimately a massive exercise of government enforcement discretion. There are some instances in which the legislators have actually gotten involved themselves, for example, in dietary supplement regulation, where in 1994 they passed a statute called the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which eased access to dietary supplements. But for the vast range of other alternative medicine products, they are readily available in America, even though they are formally illegal. Now, when it comes to orthodox drugs, the AIDS activists succeeded magnificently in changing FDA's policies and approaches with respect to access to drugs based on less evidence of safety and efficacy. Even though the Republicans under the Trump administration passed this right to try statute suggesting that FDA was the problem, in fact, FDA is not the problem at all. FDA was approving something like 99% of the requests for pre-approval access to these drugs. The problem, if you want to call it that, was the pharmaceutical industry, which has no particular interest in participating in these pre-approval access programs. They do more and more than they used to, but still, they don't have infinite supplies of this pre-approved drug just sitting around. They're worried about bad, uncontrolled evidence interrupting their path to approval. And most importantly, they can't charge for the drugs usually, and even when they can charge, they can only charge enough to recover their costs. So if you really want to see where the AIDS activists have had great success, don't look at pre-approval access. Look at early approval. Look at the accelerated approval program that was used recently to approve an Alzheimer's drug, which is subject to a lot of controversy now. Based on less evidence and a different type of evidence than ever would have been used in the 1980s or 1970s to approve a drug.
And that is very controversial, this Alzheimer's drug, because evidently it's driving up the cost of premiums for all of us, and some suggest that it's really not the answer whatsoever. So what drove the decision? Is it because there had been such a spare moment when we've been able to find anything to deal with Alzheimer's that we decided to go ahead, even though we don't know that this really is substantially the answer?
I think that when you point to areas of disease where there are no satisfactory remedies, whether it's certain kinds of cancer or Alzheimer's, our entire system now leans in the direction of letting people try, just try something. And I think it's indicative of that. The way this is implemented in our system is through patient advocacy. FDA drug approval used to be the business of bureaucrats and scientists, but now FDA drug approval has become a very public event, and patient advocacy groups get very, very involved in it, and they tend to argue for earlier access so that instead of the government making the risk-benefit analysis for patients and their doctors by keeping the drug off the market altogether, rather allowing patients and doctors to make their own risk-benefit analysis based on the available data. And then, of course, I'm not naive, there's the pharmaceutical industry itself, which is a powerful lobby and powerful force in Washington. And so this combination of factors has all led to a situation in which drugs are being approved earlier and on less evidence than they used to be.
Louis Grossman is with us. He is a professor of both law and history at American University. The book is called Choose Your Medicine: Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America. Now, I know there's the 600-pound gorilla in the room, and that's what's going on in America today while we are suffering under the worst in a century pandemic. And so I've got to really try to have you flesh this out for us. What is the relationship between the movements for giving people access to these you know, various forms of medical treatments, perhaps faster than ever, or really, as you say, in a discretionary way, allowing the use without enforcing certain laws. And then this movement that is side by side against compulsory treatments like vaccines, when in fact vaccines, I believe, are written into our Constitution. George Washington wanted the troops to be ready, you know, from the Revolutionary period. So help us understand this, because they seem somewhat opposed one to the other.
Well, I don't know that they're opposed. In fact, I think there's a lot of synergy between them. Vaccines are not written into the Constitution. I mean, you do point to a very real episode in which George Washington inoculated the troops against smallpox. And indeed, by the way, if you want to look at federal government involvement in mandatory vaccinations prior to COVID, the two areas where it has occurred a lot are in the military and in immigration enforcement. Rather than being in tension with each other, I think I show in this book that there's been a long history of both ideological and organizational overlap between people who were demanding access to the drugs they wanted without government interference and people who were resisting compulsory administration of drugs. Now, the former has a much longer history in America. It goes all the way back to the country's earliest years in the late 18th century, the late 1700s. Widespread compulsory vaccination didn't really rise until the late 19th century, but it is true that from the beginnings of compulsory vaccination in the late 19th century, which were, by the way, all at the state and local level, there was fierce resistance in some quarters to it. When you get to the early 20th century, you see a lot of cooperative work by the movements demanding access to medicines unhindered by government and things like the Anti-Vaccination League of America that were opposing compulsory vaccination. Because after all, a lot of the same libertarian ideology that supports one also supports the other. And I'd also point out that even today, if you look at the anti-vaccinationism in the midst of COVID, it is accompanied by a demand for freedom of therapeutic choice of the kind that I focus on in my book. Whether you're talking about ivermectin or hydroxychloroquine or other alternative remedies, the very same forces that are resisting compulsory vaccination are also demanding unhindered access to these other remedies. So I think that there's a real overlap between the movements.
Have you ever seen anything like this? Republicans now make up an increasingly disproportionate share of those who remain unvaccinated. This comes from a Kaiser Family Foundation study. Partisanship politically trumps, I hate to use that term, but age, race, education, or insurance status as a predictor of whether someone is willing to get vaccinated.
So I would certainly say that this phenomenon is not typical of the modern age. In fact, what I show in my book is the strange bipartisan politics of much of medical freedom activism, where you have AIDS activists and Pat Buchanan working together, and you have Barney Frank and Newt Gingrich working together on medical marijuana legalization and so forth. This is rather new, I would say, the pure partisanship of it. There are other examples in American history of a, let's call it, unipartisan devotion to medical freedom. In that mid-20th century period that we were talking about, where there was so much faith in the medical establishment, there were medical freedom activists focused mainly in the area of cancer, and they were overwhelmingly far right-wing activists associated with the John Birch Society and other right-wing forces. If you go back even further to the early 19th century, the Thompsonians, who I mentioned before, they were the botanical medical movement I mentioned before, mm-hmm. were very, very closely aligned with the Jacksonian Democrats in a bipartisan environment that at that time included Jacksonian Democrats on the one hand and the Whigs on the other hand. So there was a political alignment then as well. All that being said, I agree with you. Now, it is worth pointing out that the data show, as you said, that the resistance to vaccination or hesitation to vaccination is much stronger amongst the conservative Republicans than amongst progressives in America. But there are some progressive voices aligned with those conservatives, most notably, if we can call him a progressive, Robert Kennedy Jr., who has been railing against the medical establishment and the vaccine and Anthony Fauci just as much as people on the right have been.
Yeah, I did see a report even in Southern California of a lot of the folks who really are proponents of alternative medicine, and they too are in this anti-vax camp. Let me ask you, when we think about abortion, and of course the right of privacy that was inferred in Roe v. Wade, and of course we're again in the middle of a discussion which seems ongoing in our history about abortion rights and the freedom of a woman and her body. And I guess the question is about the implied right that people, you say medical freedom activists also frequently invoke notions of economic freedom, freedom of conscience, of religion, freedom of inquiry. In other words, is this something that many people feel is an implied right within the Constitution, or at least within the bundle of rights that make up the American way, that we should be able to do what we want because it is our body? And where does abortion fit into that?
Well, let's say that to start, that if you're asking about whether the courts have acknowledged this as a fundamental right, with a few exceptions, they have not. As I mentioned in the Abigail Alliance case, they rejected an asserted substantive due process right to gain access to unapproved drugs. The areas where the courts have found such rights are in the areas of abortion and contraception, and also a right to die, a right to decline to get life-ending treatment at the end of life. But the courts are not really where the action is in this area. I will add, by the way, that in the years immediately after Roe v. Wade, in the 1970s, Roe v. Wade was decided in 1973, there was a moment when it looked like Roe v. Wade would be spun out into a broader medical rights opinion. Roe v. Wade was used to support the right to medical marijuana in a decision, to acupuncture, and to a drug called Laetril, which was an apricot pit-derived cancer remedy in the 1970s. But ultimately, the courts didn't pursue that path. If the courts decide that there is no substantive due process right to abortion, it has less impact than it otherwise might have with respect to medical freedom more broadly. Although I will say, by the way, that it's going to be interesting to see whether a principled distinction can be drawn between the denial of a substantive due process right in the case of abortion versus the support of one in the case of contraception, or whether that is also subject to threat now. The ultimate implications to medical freedom of an overturn of Roe v. Wade will be interesting to watch.
You talk about therapeutic choice and health insurance. You delved into that later on in the book. And I'm just curious about that because when you are denied, you know, the ability to pay for some kind of treatment, what does that bring up in relation to the freedom actually to go forward with that? I mean, obviously you can pay for it out of your own pocket, but that gets to all kinds of issues about equality and inequality in terms of access to medicine. So how much does that play into it? I know during the whole debate, and you can help us through this again with Obamacare, as it was called, the Affordable Care Act, death panels and such. I mean, bring us to where that debate and the ability to get insured various practices that we might consider appropriate for us, even if they're not, you know, highly, you know, orthodox or used conventionally.
Well, there is a distinction in political philosophy between negative liberty, which is government stay out of my way, and positive liberty, which is government give me the means I need in order to pursue my goals. The phenomenon I talk about through most of the book is the negative liberty phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Government don't interfere with my freedom to access what I want to access. But as a practical matter, especially when it comes to orthodox medicines as opposed to alternative medicines, that negative right is useless to people if the treatment they want costs $50,000 a year. Therefore, it's important to look not only at obstacles to access, but also the insurance scheme and the extent to which insurance will pay people or reimburse people for accessing unapproved treatments. There's a very mixed record in America with respect to that. There's a surprisingly robust willingness of the insurance system, both public and private, to cover unapproved cancer drugs. But more broadly, there is a less reliable source of reimbursement from our insurance system for unapproved drugs. What I focus on in that chapter is the paradoxical assertion of tyranny and death panels and things like that by the right wing of this country when the government suggests in any way that people's health insurance will not cover an unapproved drug. And I don't really think at the end that there's a way to reconcile the supposed libertarianism of the right with this demand that funding not be cut off for a drug because FDA has decided that it's not effective.
Let me take us into another controversy of the modern era. You said about the right to die that, how did you phrase it earlier? But I mean, right now we have a lot of debate going on and a lot of ambivalence on the part of the American public about physician assisted suicide. And yet I would argue that that goes on all the time. I mean, whether they withdraw the opioids, whatever happens at end of life, with a family sitting around a bed in a hospital or at home with hospice, it is going on. But just the as you talk about, you know, a positive versus a negative right, I mean, the fact that something actually is going on that we just look away as opposed to sanctioning.
Yeah, so what I was referring to before was the court-recognized right to decline medical treatment at the end of life. But there's a different phenomenon which you have brought up, which is physician-assisted suicide, which is, can a doctor help you obtain or even administer a life-ending drug when you are reaching your final agonized moments? The politics behind this are interesting because on the one hand, that seems a lot like just a medical freedom demand. It's yet another drug that people want to be able to access and another medical service that people want to be able to access without government interference. But while this movement is roughly contemporaneous with the medical marijuana movement, for example, and the medical marijuana movement swept the country to the point where the vast majority of states now allow medical marijuana, I look at a day in Massachusetts where simultaneously this famously liberal state overwhelmingly supported medical marijuana, but voted down legalization of physician-assisted suicide. And again, it comes to the strange politics surrounding this and the strange bedfellows who opposed physician-assisted suicide. you have this odd alliance of, on the one hand, religious fundamentalists and Catholics and the medical establishment in many cases on one side of the spectrum, but they are in alliance in opposition to physician-assisted suicide with a lot of disability groups and a lot of people of color who basically think that physician-assisted suicide will be used as a shortcut by society to avoid giving them the resources, accommodations they need, if you're talking about disabled citizens, and sometimes tipping over into a conspiracy theory that this is the leading edge of a way to reduce the population of undesirables in the country. And so when you combine those forces, political forces, you can end up defeating a physician-assisted suicide initiative, even in Massachusetts. And indeed, during the same period of time that state after state after state has endorsed medical marijuana, many fewer states have legalized physician-assisted suicide.
How fluid are all these issues? Again, the book is called Choose Your Medicine, Freedom of Therapeutic Choice in America. I know that there was a certain amount of eugenics being done in California until the 1970s. The right to contraception, which we talked about earlier, really was not formalized until, 1965 from a Connecticut case, Griswold versus the state of Connecticut. I mean, where are we headed here as you see it? And particularly in the context of the most recent pandemic, where there is this push and pull as it relates to, me trying whatever I want to try, and the society saying, well, for the betterment of all of us, some of these more orthodox approaches, may be the only route out of here. And some of what you are trying and telling us, you have the right to do in lieu of, is not going to get the society where it needs to go. I mean, how much do you think that is going to move some of these subjects that we've been talking about that are historically significant and certainly have been around for, our entire history? Where do you think that's going to move us as we go forward?
I think we have to draw a distinction between communicable diseases and non-communicable diseases. When you're talking about illnesses that at least directly affect the fate only of the sufferer of that disease, I think America is firmly on the path toward fairly robust freedom of choice, at least more robust than it was in the 1960s, say. When it comes to communicable diseases, I don't know. The big contrast to draw between today and an earlier phase of American history is comparing the coronavirus vaccine, the COVID vaccine, to the polio vaccine. The polio vaccine, invented by Jonas Salk in the 1950s, was celebrated, and Americans willingly rolled up their sleeves by the millions to participate not only in administration of the drug post-approval, but even in clinical trials of the drug, of the vaccine. Jonas Salk was a celebrity on the level of Mickey Mantle or James Dean, and it was just a cause of pride and celebration in America. Compare Jonas Salk in American culture to Anthony Fauci, and I think you can see how much things have changed. So where do things go in America? I have to continue to think that if COVID, especially a variant of COVID, were to start killing many more people, especially younger people, then you might see something of a change in attitude. After all, polio was a childhood disease. Would things be going the same way in America if COVID was particularly fatal, not in our oldest population, but amongst children or teenagers? Hmm. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I suspect it would be different. I will also add that even in the midst of all of this anti-vaccination activism, we still have a population where, I don't know, between 70 and 75% of Americans have received at least one dose of the COVID vaccine. Mm-hmm. So we're not talking about a majority of Americans opposing it. The problem, of course, is when you're talking about a communicable disease, you need a level of uptake that leads to herd immunity, even 30% or 20% of the population resisting vaccination can be enough to ruin the whole program. I don't really know what to tell you, Larry. I'd like to think that the United States won't commit suicide over medical libertarianism, but I guess that remains to be seen.
As you look at any other issues, we've touched on abortion, we've touched on right to die or suicide assisted by a physician. What are the other issues that you think, either in the courts or in the court of public opinion or protest, do you think the American public is going to rise up as it relates to their therapeutic choice going forward?
I think the next area to look at once we, God willing, get through the pandemic is psychedelics. Psilocybin and other psychedelics have been shown in some studies to be useful against various types of mental disease, including post-traumatic stress and depression. Like medical marijuana, they, in many instances, are derived from natural sources, mushrooms, and so forth. You see a brewing movement in America now to start legalizing psychedelics in the same way that medical marijuana was legalized. And Oregon was, if I have this right, was the first state to actually do so. So we have one state now that has legalized psilocybin and maybe some other psychedelics, I forget, for medical purposes. California actually has an initiative that would be a much broader legalization initiative that would, if I remember correctly, would not be limited to medical uses and would cover a broader range of substances. That's the area to watch, Larry. I think that over the next 20 years, you may start to see legalization of these substances in a way very parallel to the legalization of medical marijuana over the previous 20 years.
Very interesting. My last question, what does that say about the parity that we've arrived at as it relates to our physical health and our mental health?
Well, I don't think we have parity yet, sadly, but we're getting closer. You know, for a long time, mental health was shushed up. It wasn't openly acknowledged when people had depression or other mental disorders. And I think that America is much more honest and much more open about it than they used to be. So for the most part, you didn't see medical marijuana being legalized as an antidote to stress or depression or anything like that. It was for physical ailments like glaucoma and AIDS wasting syndrome and things like that. It is the case that if psychedelics are ultimately legalized, at least at the state level, it will be based almost exclusively on their efficacy against mental disease, including the PTSD suffered by our veterans. And so I think that there's undeniably some societal progress reflected in that movement.
Lewis Grossman, Choose Your Medicine, fascinating topic, freedom of therapeutic choice in America. I thank you so much for being with us on America Trends.
Thank you for having me, Larry. I really enjoyed it.